This is an OSV Podcasts production. To learn more about OSV Podcast Network, visit osvpodcasts.com.
People won't remember that. They won't remember when we used to get little ads of an anchor saying this one word and then more at 5. More maybe, at 11.
Maybe if they
do they do that anymore? I don't think they do.
The only place they do that now is the YouTube video where it's all front loaded with why is it that you never lose weight when you do this and this and this and you wait for half an hour?
Yes, right.
And the skip, you're like the skip ad button's there and you're like, oh, I'm kind of hooked.
Yeah.
But
oh, yeah.
I want to fresh this.
Yeah. I really remember it because Kentucky Fried Movie does those things. I'm not wearing any pants. More at 11.
On that note, this is 10,000 Places.
This is 10,000 Places.
Sorry, the 10,000 Places podcast.
The 10,000 Places podcast, yes.
Podcast, hashtag rebrand.
Hashtag rebrand. Who are you?
I'm Justin Aquila.
I'm Lewis Pearson.
Who am I?
Our friend.
I'm Alex Gildner.
Alex Gildner.
Alex Gildner.
Yeah. And have I told you about my problem with brands?
No.
I have a feeling you're going to, though.
I have problems with brands, too, but.
That's what you do to cattle. You brand them. Mm-hmm. I mean, people talk about branding themselves these days. Like we're just doing Satan's work for them. Just
I'm branded by my baptism.
Mm. Wait, is that a brand?
It's a mark that's impressed upon you.
Yeah, indelible mark.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so what do we do in branding ourselves?
I don't know. I brand myself with tattoos.
Yeah.
I haven't done it in a long time, but I used to. My students always get that. I love the first day of class when I first roll up my sleeves, and they're like, he's got tattoos. As if, like, I don't know. They think I'm going to be a crusty old dude who walks in and reads from this huge dusty tome all day.
You should do that.
But I should totally do that.
I do dress the parts. I wear the leather patches on the blazer. You tell them, you know what firemen and policemen
that's
look like.
Classy.
You got to dress the parts so they feel like they're in college and have something to aspire to.
So I don't know how to transition into our actual topic.
Well, something you guys said at the last episode, if anyone's heard it, that we're doing a Vatican II series. And we spent two episodes talking about the Enlightenment.
Right.
We're setting the stage to Vatican I because Vatican II is actually a sequel.
Yes.
And something that the two of you said together at the end was one thing that was happening right before Vatican I, which the church did in Vatican I, which angered a lot of people, but which they've done in every age, is they try to find the good in every age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what struck me is what's fascinating about that is, of course, you're going to anger people because the easy attempt at finding resolution when there's conflict is to say yes to A or yes to B and to reject the one or reject the other. And so what's going to happen with the church is if it's going to say, look, these new myths about where humans come from and what we're made for are false, but the age has more to offer us than just these justifications that are trying to establish the trajectory of social life.
Yeah.
So to say these are the good things of the age, but these are the things that the tradition has given us that are going to infuse the age with life and truth, you hold two things together, you're going to piss people off on both sides.
Right.
Because the age wants you to get rid of your tradition. And the tradition, some kinds of people, want you to just sequester yourself in the tradition and get rid of the age as if that's not the time and place God has put you in.
Right.
And the church has always said, no, we've got to hold on to both.
I would offer one qualification to that, and that is that if there were a time when the church was most unwilling to accept ideas from her age, it would be Vatican I. That is not that she was completely unwilling, but if there was a time when she was most unwilling, that was probably it. Maybe Trent. I am not contravening what you've said. What you've said is absolutely true. And I think in the interesting story of what?
Nothing. I think you said absolutely.
Oh. Well, Lewis?
That's a bumper sticker. Absolutely.
Instead of ask politely. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And so, now we're in the branding business.
And we're back. Oh, absolutely true what you just said, Lewis. But I think one of the really interesting things about the Vatican I, Vatican II story is more of the accepting the modern ideas came in Vatican II.
Mm-hmm.
More of the seriously, strongly establishing what the church cannot let go came in Vatican I. They both have both.
Mm-hmm.
But that is why there is a sense in which they are in some way a single council.
Yeah, they're complementary in that way.
They are very complementary. And I will continue to harangue this thesis that Vatican I and Vatican II must be understood together.
Yeah.
And that's why we're doing this whole long thing.
Yeah. But I've been conditioned to have trilogies. Like, where's the third one that's going to show up?
I think Vatican III is coming. And who knows? I can tell you, I don't know what's going to be said there, but I'll tell you what's not going to be said there. Women priests.
Yeah, that's another episode.
Yeah.
We're trambling down the road to Vatican I.
Right. And so where we left off was we talked about all of this kind of cacophony of various thought forms of modernism, post-enlightenment, all this kind of stuff that basically hovered around these two major questions. How do we know things and what place does history have in reality? And this brings down the question of revelation. We can't jettison that, right? The Catholic Church is saying, no, we can't. Also, we have a strong tradition that we can know things by natural reason and natural knowledge. And so a brand new era of completely questioning the validity of any sort of revealed religion had emerged. And Catholics in the intellectual sphere started taking these questions seriously and trying to either absorb them or rebut them. And they did so by a few different thought forms, and then one, I think, more political stance, and that is traditionalism, ontologism, Thomism, or neo-Thomism, neo-scholasticism, and then this kind of weird political slash doctrinal position called Anshulmontanism.
Can I just do a 30-second on why, because I don't think we've hit this yet, why revelation is so important?
Absolutely.
There is a Constitution of Vatican II on this, so I want to save it, but just contextually, Christianity is a revealed religion. What we know of God, there are certain things we can know of him by natural reason, but what we know of God, specifically of the revelation of Jesus Christ, God has to reveal himself to us in order to be as known as he is.
And in order to be saved.
In order for salvation. And so without that knowledge, Christianity is nothing.
That's right. And that revelation cannot be deduced by any natural resources that a human has, including their very powerful, very formidable ability to use reason, whether or not humans actually do a thing we could probably talk about.
If I remember, I think Thomas says in the Summa Contra Gentiles, one theoretically could deduce this if one spent their entire life doing it and pretty much nothing else.
And what was that one thing?
Thinking about God and figuring out who he is by revelation.
Oh, who he is by revelation.
And so Thomas, I think if I remember
correctly, even agree with him on that.
Yeah.
I don't think he agrees with himself, though, by the time he gets to the Summa Theologia. I mean, he abandoned the Summa Contra Gentiles because he actually came to the conclusion that you actually can't do this with no recourse to revelation. Yeah.
What I like about what he says is, though, that in a sense, revelation is a democratic act in the sense that God knows we can't just sit around thinking of him all day.
Mm-hmm.
So that the most amount of people could come into contact with who God is, he has to reveal himself.
I'd have to think about that, but I get where you're going.
Yeah.
And so definitely, like, we're a revealed religion and there's no way around that.
Well, I'd say also, one, if you haven't read Summa Contra Gentiles, when I started reading that, I thought, oh, this is lovely. It's so much different from the Summa Theologiae.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I'd recommend anyone who hasn't read it to read it because it's very different.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And I'd also say, just to make a quick case for revelation, so this doesn't sound too sort of strange and mystical, and you have to be a card-carrying Catholic member to just be okay with this pronouncement the church is going to make about revelation. There are all kinds of things in life we cannot know unless someone tells us.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
including yourself. Like, I can't know you unless, except from what you reveal to me.
Yeah.
Or that you've revealed to another person and I accept their testimony about you.
I can deduce things about you from body language.
Right.
From other things that I see, I can forensically try to put together a story that may more or less be the case, but even the best forensic detective is going to miss certain things like the secret contents of your mind that you don't. But this isn't just a Christian thing. There's all kinds of things, who your mom was, that revelation is just, if you get away from the fancy word, is that which is revealed, meaning there is someone who's showing you something that you couldn't see before.
Yeah.
It was hidden from you. Your reason couldn't have uncovered it alone.
Right.
And reason uncovers a lot, but that which is revealed is something that's also part of all of our lives. Testimony is revelation.
Yeah.
It's something being told to
us. So revelation, as the Catholic might put it, is built into the logic of the universe itself.
Yeah. So there's many things we can know about. There's got to be a God. He's got to be good. There's got to be one. He's got to be perfect. The pagans knew this. But there's many things about God, who he is and what he meant for us and how we're related to him, that we can't know fully unless he talks to us.
Yeah.
Like, I could deduce that I have a father if I had never met him. But there's things about him I couldn't know if I'd never met him.
Right.
Even if I had people telling me stories, all the stories about my dad are not the same as having a relationship with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Christian revelation is saying is that is something that you can't figure out.
Right.
A relationship has to be given to you.
Mm-hmm. And I would add, the foundation of reality is not nature, it's person. Mm-hmm. There is something other than nature, which means you can't even talk about the nature of a person or the nature of personhood in any totally real sense, because that's an abstraction. And persons cannot be abstractions. They can't be.
Or concrete, yep.
Yep. And so if God is a three-person relation in one nature, then one of the fundamentals of existence itself cannot be abstracted into a nature. It is person. And that leads to the Catholic's radical, robust vision of the dignity of the person.
Yeah.
That is the weight of the glory of the person. Mm-hmm. And we have been made in that image that we are persons too, right? And so revelation is necessary. You can't get a who truly unless person reveals that to you.
Yeah.
And you get things about that person. You can get what that person is in a sense, but
the way I often push this in a different context with the ultimate stories about where things come from in the world, there's a person behind all things, or there's things behind all persons. The atheist who claims everything came from nothing and persons are part of the everything has to claim that it was just junk, physical stuff, that eventually somehow formed itself into what we now call persons.
Right.
Or the Christian story that says, the Judeo-Christian story, no, there's a person behind all things, and that's the fundamental story.
Right.
But you can't have anything revealed, including things that people are trying to sell you. There's a little ad break here.
So what began as a 30-second thing that Justin was going to say about Revelation.
Sorry.
No, it was very good, actually. So we're probably not going to get to Vatican I this episode.
So what's in the way of us and Vatican I? There's a few
To the modern things. And the one that's going to take the most time is Thomism. But let's get through traditionalism and ontologism really quick. Traditionalism is pretty simple. It's we can know nothing for certain unless it is revealed to us. Okay? Like our
reason, one extreme.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Our reason is not, it can give us no final word on anything, including whether or not God exists. Mm-hmm. Right?
It's almost a sola scriptura kind of move from the Protestant world.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that parallel. But yeah, so unless God reveals it, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's where all of it comes from. And so traditionalism is the absolute epistemological condition of tradition itself, right? We can only know what the magisterium tells us. And then ontologism is kind of the far...
That's actually what people assume from the outside of
Catholicism. Yeah, what Catholicism thinks, yeah, which is not true at all. Right, right. And so this is where the whole blind faith misconstrual of Catholicism comes from. And then on the far other extreme is ontologism. Now, this is probably a little bit inside baseball, but I can't help it because I had to talk about this in my dissertation. So somebody needs to hear it as well.
Buckle up.
No, I won't. I won't go. But ontologism was a peculiar style of thought that was attached to various people, including people who have now been cleared of it in a sense, like Rosmini. But basically, it came out of Italy and then really established itself in the Belgian and German world. The idea is that the way we know things, and he's particularly Gioberti who came up with this, is particularly responding to Cartesian and atheism, he's responding to rationalism. We know things and can know all our sense experiences and everything else because the actual ontos, the actual essence of God, inhabits our minds. And everybody has an intuitive, natural awareness of God's essence, and that's how they know everything they know, and that's the condition for the certainty of their knowledge, which is very close to, but nevertheless a bastardization of Augustine / Bonaventure's illumination epistemology.
I can see that.
And so he called this ontologism. And it actually, even though nobody's probably ever really heard this word and maybe does think I'm making a self-indulgent detour, it actually was a hugely controversial topic and idea that really latched on, especially at the University of Louvain. And so propositions of ontologism were condemned not once but twice in 1855 and in 1861. And then later on, certain propositions by Rosmini, who has now been rehabilitated, particularly by John Paul II in Fides et Ratio, when we talk about the encyclicals that change our lives, right? That episode's coming down the pike. But anyway, ontologism was such a big deal that it had these very specific condemnations. And the problem is, unlike traditionalism, which completely undoes rationalism, ontologism, in some sense, removes the need for revelation at all. Mm-hmm. And it makes several missteps that assume that we actually have an immediate and thus not natural in any way sense of reality. Everything is almost supernaturalized. And it harkens back to like Averroistic Aristotelian notions of God being our intellect or being our passive intellect, which is more Avicenna, but yeah.
Yeah, Averroes is a Muslim interpreter of Aristotle, who is Aquinas would have been in dialogue with.
Yes, and was deeply formed by, even though he did end up disagreeing very stringently with a few things that Averroism
Aquinas
said.
Was, obviously.
Well, and that's a great transition, because here's the big boy that came in as the response to modernism that really changed everything, and that was Neo-Thomism. Mm-hmm. Neo-Thomism could be defined in many ways, but I'm going to define it right now as the notion that Thomas can answer any problem ever. And that Thomas's
angry emails begin.
Yes, and that Thomas's doctrines are, or at least should be, the doctrines of the church.
That would, I think, be a decent thumbnail definition.
And well, if you disagree with Thomas, then you're disagreeing with the church.
I had a friend who's a listener of our show ask, "Dude, why does Alex hate Thomas?" And I said, "Well, he doesn't. First, he's a Bonaventure scholar.
I love Thomas, by the way."
I'm speaking for myself, maybe for all three of us, that I find a lot of his work not only edifying, but upbuilding. I enjoy a lot of his. I teach his stuff all the time, not begrudgingly.
I teach Thomas in my class, and not just as a foil.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the point here is the church was looking for some kind of intellectual bulwark, something that had a lot of resources in it to answer many of the problems of the modern age. And what they saw in Thomas, he had in some ways given a kind of perfected exemplar of what it looks like in the kind of question format of engaging many different voices and synthesizing what's best and completing what was lacking in giving the pronouncement from tradition, scripture, the church. And so they saw in him not only a method, but also in the content, a lot of good answers.
Right.
And what happens is, fast forward to now, it's almost like what happens with people who have catechesis up to confirmation and then nothing. Mm-hmm. And so we get them in our classes and in our parishes, and we see people who are thinking as 13-year-olds, and they are completely being just taken down by the culture because they have nothing beyond that. I don't think Thomas would like that he's the only person we read from our own tradition.
Yes, yeah, I agree. Yeah. If I could just explain why I don't like Neo-Thomism, and how it's not that I don't even like all things in Neo-Thomism or that I don't like Thomas. I love Thomas.
So like, I don't like Neoplatonism. I like parts of it.
Yes.
But Neoplatonism is different from Platonism, which is different from Plato.
Right.
And Neo-Thomism is different from Thomism, which is also different from Thomas.
Right. There's lots of different kinds of Thomism, first of all.
Yeah.
And they're all different from Thomas in some way, because as we've been talking about, kind of one of the themes shot through all this is that idea systems are built out of responses to other current idea systems. And so anybody who's going to latch on to Thomas or Bonaventure or Augustine or whoever and formulate a response to issues and problems and objections of their time are not going to just quote that person. And I would say that sometimes that might be the attempt of what someone's trying to do. There are Neo-Thomists who would say, no, we are just exegetically representing Thomas. But I don't think that's true of anybody. I think it's a good try, possibly. I do think the Neo-Thomists get Thomas wrong on a few things, but that's not important. What happened that's problematic, in my opinion, is that somehow in the mix of all this, Thomas became the only one we need from the tradition. Mm-hmm. And that is deeply problematic and really sad.
When I talk to educated Catholics or even priests, we start talking philosophy or theology.
Yeah.
We have so many things we could talk about. And I meant for this to be a conversation, not a teaching moment where I'm explaining to you Plato or somebody else. I thought you studied philosophy. No, you just studied Thomas. And that's a great person to study, but what about all the rest of it?
Right. And so what a lot of Thomists do is they, in ways that I think even Thomas didn't do, presume a utterly Aristotelian metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And they divest even Thomas of real currents of Platonism, including Neoplatonism, that Thomas accepted. And then also,
I'm continually impressed when I see him covering Plato, and he didn't have Plato in the original at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Would they have Catullus?
Yeah. He had the tradition that Plato had established.
Yeah, no. And like the whole Summa's actual structure is an exitus reditus structure, which is the Neoplatonist structure of the universe. But that's a whole other episode of how do we interpret Thomas. But what happened here, and this is very important for Vatican I, and then what happens, because this hegemony, as I like to call it, is going to be the context for Vatican II.
Mm-hmm. And I would argue the subsequent response.
Right, because, which is Nivea Theologiae and Ressourcement and all that.
Yeah, well, also because those who are formed in Thomistic worldview, which was pretty much everyone who went to seminary,
right,
in some ways still, their worldview is thrown off a little bit because Vatican II is incorporating Thomas, but more than Thomas.
Right, exactly. Just a very brief story. Two guys come along. There's more than two of them, but I'm going to focus on two. Who are convinced 100% that Thomas figured everything out and that we can take nothing from the modern philosophers at all. It all has to be destroyed, refuted, and it's all aimed at all kinds of specifics about, you know, the German distinction between Vernunft and Verstand and all kinds of not interesting things to anybody but me. But they say we need to have the church completely adopt the Thomistic system as we understand it. And one of them was named Josef Kleutgen, who is an absolutely bizarre figure. He was very deep in the political machinations behind both Pius IX and Leo XIII. And while people still love his philosophy who like Neo-Thomism, he was a horrifying person who, I mean, was involved in plots to kill people and was having relations with nuns all this. And this is not like rumors. This is like he was actually even disciplined at times by the church for having done these things. But he had a completely worked out system of Neo-Thomism. And he is one of the authors of Dei Filius,
which is one of the
Vatican I documents. Yeah, so, I mean, he's huge. The other figure is Louis Taparelli. Louis Taparelli was an educator at what was then called the Roman College, now called the Gregorian. People think Thomism was the only thing around. No, it's because of these two men especially that Thomism became the only system. In the Roman College before this time, it was considered problematic to only assume one system. You had to know Thomas, you had to know Scotus, you had to know certain manualists, you know, the Suarezian tradition and all this. You were supposed to know all these different things. And Louis Taparelli actually was dismissed from the Roman College, from the Greg, because he would only teach Thomism. Because he was convinced that Thomism was the only answer to these modern thoughts.
Sidebar. He's largely considered the father of Catholic social teaching. And
this is not me saying I disagree with everything Kleutgen or Taparelli says, but I have disagreements with their general notion that Thomas has all the answers and the church should just adopt his thought full tilt. So he's dismissed from the Greg, but he had a very, very important student named Giacchino Pecci. Now, Giacchino Pecci has a very illustrious clerical career, becomes a bishop of Perugia. And while he's at Perugia, he institutes a complete reform of the school system there. And he says, no more anything but Thomas. We are only learning Thomas. That is all we need. And that's what we're going to learn. And so he does this complete reform. And it seems to him very successful in addressing these modern problems. And this, of course, Giacchino Pecci is who is going to become Pope Leo XIII. And so when Pope Leo XIII, right on the heels of the Vatican Council, Vatican I, or no, it's a little bit later, because then in 1879, Leo XIII is going to publish Aeterni Patris, which is going to argue that, look at this beautiful tradition we have. Now, the scholastics summed it up perfectly for us, so we don't necessarily need to read the patristics to know what our tradition is. And then Thomas sums up the best of the scholastics, except for maybe Bonaventure, but who cares? Thomas actually sums up everything we need to know about that. So Thomas is really all we need to fight modern philosophy, and that's what he names it in the document of Aeterni Patris. And then what does he do? He institutes his reform at Perugia at the universal educational scale, including all the seminaries. And so for the next 70 years, aside from some aberrations that we're going to talk about, everybody is learning Neo-Thomism. And they're learning it to an extent that if you do not agree with every aspect of how Neo-Thomism presents Thomas and his doctrines, you are suspect.
Yep. And sometimes lumped in unfairly with the modernists.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, if you're listening astutely, listener, you'll have recognized there are certain aspects of Neo-Thomism that could only exist because of the modern era. Modern philosophy.
Yeah,
so there are certain assumptions about the problems of epistemology that wouldn't have existed for Thomas, because he doesn't have a Cartesian gap between the sensible and the intelligible world. He doesn't have Kantian idealism and the notion of intuitive knowledge versus discursive understanding. He doesn't have this problem of how does philosophy relate to theology and what sense is it an autonomous discipline? Okay, so these things that Neo-Thomism formulates are going to be, in their minds, developments of what he obviously would have said in this context. But we can't know that.
Yeah.
And it's going to lead to a lot of things. It's Thomism becomes the currency. And so then you got, you know, like your Gilson people who are trying to figure out, okay, so what does this mean? Thomas is the best, but we've got a whole other tradition. And then you have your people like Gary Goulet-Grange, who is going to carry this tradition on to the letter. And he is going to be one of the most important figures before Vatican II. And Vatican II is going to, we might get some hate mail on this one too, upend and overturn a lot of what Gary Goulet-Grange tried to accomplish.
I'd say that for a listener learning this for the first time, some knee-jerk emotional reactions might be to just say, well, so that's good, so why are you down on it? Or to feel bad about himself and think, so I don't know anything else and I should know other things. And I'd say, for better and for worse, we're just saying this is what happened.
Yeah, right.
So
it doesn't make Thomas bad. It doesn't make all of Neo-Thomism bad.
Yeah. And if that's all you've been taught, that's not a bad thing.
And Thomas is a pretty good education how to think.
Yes.
But it is to say this is something that you can use as a platform for learning more.
Right.
Yeah, I would say, too, one of the issues is you're bringing the wrong tool to fix the problem.
Like anybody, a knife to a gunfight.
Yeah, anybody who's done any
kind of... Well, a hammer versus a screwdriver. Or,
anybody who's done any kind of labor knows that the right tool makes the job easier.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And sometimes,
I've used the wrong tool a lot.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes the right intellectual tool provides the right response. And Thomas isn't, or at least Neo-Thomism isn't always the right response.
Yes, that's right. And I would say one of the problems of Neo-Thomism, that aside from the one that I've just laid out very clearly, which is the notion that it's the only thing we're allowed to believe, or that it is the perfect expression of what the church teaches and believes, those are obvious problems. Mm-hmm. But also, I think one problem with the presumption, at least, the presupposition behind at least Neo-Thomism, is that we can learn nothing from these modern philosophies.
Right.
And as Lewis explained very, very well at the beginning of this episode, we can't take that position. That's not how the church deals with things, and it's not how we should either. And so while there are things, and maybe even most of the things that come out of modernism we should totally reject, JP2 is a perfect example. And he was at Vatican II.
As a bishop.
Yep. Yeah. And he was one of the authors behind Gaudium et Spes.
Correct.
But his personalism that comes from his formation in both Thomism and phenomenology, I would say, is a very, very important thought form emergence that we should all be paying attention to. And it's a perfect example of why you can learn things from the modern zeitgeist and still maintain a good Orthodox theology that takes us deeper down the journey towards knowing and understanding God in the world.
Mm-hmm. I found this helpful for me. All right, so Jesus comes, he reveals himself in the incarnation. We have the whole prior revelation that in what we now call the Old Testament of God, but Jesus brings that to fulfillment. The church is then put on mission with the aid of the Holy Spirit to carry that revelation down through the ages. Mm-hmm. What happens, of course, is different clarifications are needed in that theology. Christianity is in dialogue with different cultures and traditions and needs to respond or clear the way for revelation.
Mm-hmm.
So theology develops
as a
kind of companion to unpack revelation.
Right. And that is the purpose in many ways of the theologian.
Right. It's the vocation and the mission of the theologian. So sometimes the theologian, or the theological currents, it may be better to say, is maybe clouding revelation.
Yes.
By sticking to a particular way of expressing
right.
the truth. What I'm not saying is that what has gone before us in the tradition of theology doesn't matter. Some
right.
people accuse defenders of Vatican II of that. Like we're
right.
making this break between
rupture.
Yeah, the yeah. rupture. No. What I'm saying is that there's been truth articulated and unpacked in these theologies, these theological systems, which are incredibly relevant today, but theology has to continue to, while being faithful to revelation,
mm-hmm.
that's where theology goes awry when it is not faithful to revelation,
right.
while still faithful to revelation, has to adapt to dialogue with the particular cultures in which it
because
exists.
Because every new culture, every new thought system, every new zeitgeist is going to have its own unique idiosyncratic
yeah.
questions,
yeah.
problems,
yeah.
and assumptions that the church has not encountered before.
Right.
Not in that particular nexus.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, because there is a sense in which there's no new thought under the sun, and then there's also a sense in which that has never been said that way right. with those kinds of things.
Or just a moral problem, right?
Right.
I mean, there's been contraception throughout the generations. The pill radically changes
right.
what contraception is, and so humani vitae is needed, and then subsequently
right.
John Paul II's unpacking of it in theology.
Exactly. Body. Yeah, and so this is what I think is meant by what the Catechism says, that the church presents her whole self anew to every generation.
Ever ancient, ever new.
Listeners, I think this is part of the journey that we're going on and that we're trying to take you on is how do we navigate this?
Yeah.
Because these lessons that we're going to be learning from what we've talked about and when we talk about Vatican I and Vatican II and pretty much this whole podcast is how do you navigate a world that's always telling you things that doesn't just have a position of complete bunker, you know, negation, but is not also just going to say, I will swallow this whole thing whole and just believe in all the crazy ideologies and notions that the culture teaches us. How do you stay a faithful Catholic who is relevant, but who is not useless and who is faithful to what the church teaches and what the Holy Spirit is telling us to say now? Our next time, we'll be talking about Vatican I proper, finally, and moving into the legacy of Vatican I and how that sets up Vatican II. You can always get in touch with us, 10,000placespodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. If you totally disagree with us, let us know. We'd love to hear what you think. Until that time, I am Alex Giltner.
I'm Justin Aquila.
I'm Lewis Pearson. This is the 10,000 Places Podcast.
Nobody knows when to do the things you do.
This has been a production of OSV Podcasts. To learn more, visit osvpodcasts.com.